Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome once again to History Dweebs. I am Tim. Welcome to the podcast where we take a lighthearted look at the dark side of history. Today we're going to talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Company fire that occurred back in 1911 and killed 146 garment workers in New York City. Kind of a tragic event, and we're going to discuss that. But before we do, let me remind everyone that we are a comedy podcast and we use adult language. So if adult language offends you,
We don't know if we're a comedy podcast, but we definitely use adult language.
Yes, we do. We can say that for certain, that we're going to probably use adult language, although we don't curse as much.
We don't curse like when Brandy's really the one that gets us at E rating.
She really is. She cusses like a sailor.
Oh, she's a foul mouth whore to me.
And Brandy is on assignment in North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
She's visiting with the
her cousin
Kim Jong Un, hanging out there, probably playing video games with him, and drinking riced wine or whatever they drink over there in North Korea.
Playing the they play cards against humanity for real over there, Timmy.
They do, don't they? But anyway, Brandy's not with us today, but she'll be with us next time or soon. We're just having problems with the holidays getting all three of us together, and
we don't like her, Timmy.
Well, I didn't want to say that. This was kind of our cover. But anyway, I am joined by the man who's considered the most dangerous man in podcasting today, a man who has been described as an oasis in the desert of despair. I'm talking about, of course, the very honorable, the Reverend Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as the Southern Gentleman. How are you today, Colonel?
Oh, not bad, Timmy. Not bad. It's cold out.
It is cold out. Now, I know, Colonel, you've worked in some sweatshops in your day.
I have.
Yes.
I've actually owned a few.
So this is right up your alley, then, this mm-hmm. story. Do you know, have you studied this story much?
I have, Timmy.
Okay,
I
so
have.
You got some background.
Yeah, because I made sure that my factories were fireproof, Timmy.
I see. So you're benevolent.
You're well, benevolent. As long as they worked, yeah.
Yeah. All right. So you want to just jump into the story?
Let's jump right into
all
it,
right.
Timmy.
So on March 25th, 1911... a fire broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory in New York City. The fire in New York City on March 25, 1911, was the deadliest industrial disaster in the history of the city, one of the deadliest in U.S. history. The 500 workers, who were mostly young women, located on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floor of the Ash Building. It's kind of ironic that this is called
the Ash Building.
Yeah. Sadly.
They caught it before and after the Ash Building.
Yeah. 8th, 9th, and 10th floors. They tried to escape, but due to poor conditions, locked doors, and a faulty fire escape, 146 of these folks, workers, died in the fire. The large number of deaths in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire exposed the dangerous conditions and high-rise factories at the time and prompted the creation of new building fire and safety codes throughout the United States. So, give you a little background. The Triangle Shirtwaist Company was owned by two men, Max Blank and Isaac Hayes. Isaac Hayes.
That's
shit. It would be cool if it was Isaac Hayes.
Isaac Hayes is one bad mother.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It was Max Blank and Isaac Harris. Both men immigrated from Russia as young men, and they met when they got to the United States. And by 1900, they had a little shop together on Woodstard Street in New York. They named it the Triangle Shirtwaist Company. The business grew quickly, and within a couple of years, Max Blank and Isaac Harris were wealthy men. I should explain, I guess, what a shirtwaist is. If you remember, Colonel, seeing pictures of women dressed in the turn of the 20th century, they'll have this shirt that kind of looks like it's like a blouse that's untucked.
Yeah.
And then they'll have a dress underneath right. it. That's what they made. They call them shirtwaists. And they were very popular from the late 1900s to the early 20th century. The business grew quickly, and within a couple of years, as I said, both Max and Isaac were wealthy men. They were a true American success story, going from poor immigrants living in a crowded tenement to living in fine Fifth Avenue homes all in a matter of a few years. Growing quickly, they moved their business to the top three floors of a new 10-story building called the Ash Building in New York City. It's near Washington Square in New York City for all of our listeners in New York.
It's now New York University's Brown Building right
yes,
now.
Yes, yes. It's a part of New York University now, still stands, and I think it's a national landmark now, mm-hmm. or at least a New York City landmark. The factory, which consisted of row after row of electric sewing machines, so this is in the garment district, were located on the 8th, 9th, and 9th floors, while on the 10th floor were office buildings, sales, administrative offices, and that's where Max and Isaac had their offices on the 10th floor. By 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Company was one of the largest blouse makers in New York City. It employed 500 garment workers, mostly young women ranging in the age from 10 to 50. This is before child labor laws, so they had a lot of kids working there, or at least
before
teenagers.
The government got its nose all up in capitalism and wouldn't let us work those little kids.
Yeah. What's Brandy say about little fingers? Anyway, so great buttons or something. Isn't that what she says? She's heartless. Anyway, there were at the time something like 40,000 garment workers in New York City. And although working conditions at the Triangle Factory company were dangerous, it was considered one of the more modern workplaces at the time in the garment industry. Workers used electric sewing machines as opposed to some of the factories where they had the pedal machines. So it was considered a good gig, I guess, at the time. And it had large windows where, like, some of the smaller factories were just, small, dark, cramped spaces using pedal sewing machines. So this one is at least a little bit more modern, more up to date. It would have been, now today we would consider it a sweatshop, but in its time, it was, one of the more progressive factories in town. They specialized, as I said, in making shirtwaist, which was the popular women's blouse at the time.
I like a shirt with puffy sleeves.
You like puffy sleeves? Yeah, these have puffy sleeves. Yeah. You like a pirate shirt. You want a pirate shirt.
I like to loop me some booty, Timmy.
I see. The Triangle Shirtwaist Company had made Max Blank and Isaac Harris rich, largely because they exploited their workers. And, Brandy would do that, of course.
Yeah, she would. I would have been fair to my workers.
I know. You're a very benevolent.
My workers would have been fairly wealthy to me. Mm-hmm. I would have shared the wealth with the workers.
I know. You're known for your generosity, Colonel. Mm-hmm. Approximately 500 people, mostly immigrant women from Russia, East Europe, worked in the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory in the Ash Building. As I said, the factory was on the 8th and 9th floors, the 10th floor being mostly administrative offices. And as you mentioned, Colonel, the building still stands today. It's owned by New York University. The women there worked long hours, 6 days a week, in cramped quarters and were paid low wages. Many of the workers were young, some, as I said earlier, as young as 10 years old. In 1909, many of the garment workers in New York City went on strike for higher pay, a shorter work week, and to get to, be have their unions recognized. And they wanted safer work conditions. So they went out on strike, and it did not go well. Eventually, they would get a slight pay increase in their hours. They were working 18-hour days, 6 days a week, and they would bring in like $2 or $3 a week. So, you know, just enough to really to survive. But they went on strike in 1909 for better working conditions, and they actually got some support from J.P. Morgan's daughter, Anne Morgan.
Oh, yeah.
She was very active in the women's suffrage movement, and she took up their cause. And because what happened when they went out on a strike, the company, including this company, they hired prostitutes to go out on the picket line and beat up the women, and then the police would come and arrest the strikers. So, but Ann Morgan, who was J.P. Morgan, of course, wealthy banker, who I read this, that he was the Federal Reserve Bank at the time.
Yeah.
Because this was before the Federal Reserve Bank, but he pretty much guaranteed, he had so much wealth, he pretty much guaranteed the financial system in the United States. But anyway, his daughter became very sympathetic to their cause, and eventually they settled a strike. And they got better working conditions, they got better wages, and their hours were decreased, but their union was not recognized, and so they didn't improve, their working conditions didn't improve in terms of safety. So basically their conditions still kind of sucked. The women were charged, they were charged for the electricity they used, and if they made any mistakes, they were charged for those as well. The factory itself.
They were little entrepreneurs to me. You got to charge them for their cost now.
They were on, as I said, most of the women were on the 8th and 9th floor of this factory. There were two doors into the factory, and the owners kept one of them locked. And the other door was guarded by a security guard who would check the women after each shift to make sure that they were not stealing any shirts or materials. So they kept this one door locked because they wanted to be able to make sure no one could walk out with a shirt or with material or whatever. And they could only guard one door. So this comes into play when this fire occurs. Women who missed work due to pregnancy or illness were immediately fired. This forced workers to continue to go to work even when they were not feeling well, which, of course, you know, if they have some kind of virus or bug, they spread it to
everybody.
Yeah. In addition to these unpleasant conditions, women were often subjected to repeated sexual harassment by their owners and floor foremen. In 1909, as I said earlier, there was this major strike, but it didn't really improve the conditions. But it was settled, they got a little better pay, a little better, you know, hours. They didn't have to work quite as many hours, but still, the condition in the factories were not very safe. So on Saturday, March 25th, 1911, a fire started on the 8th floor. Work had just ended at 4:30 that day. It was a Saturday, so they only worked 8 hours on Saturday. And it was a warm spring day, and most of the workers were getting their belongings together and getting their paycheck, when one of the ladies noticed a small fire had started in a scrap bin. No one is sure even to this day what started the fire, but the fire marshal later would claim that he thought that a cigarette butt had possibly been tossed into this bin. Like, they would keep scraps of, I guess, material, whatever they're cutting and sewing, in its bin, and someone tossed a cigarette in there. Nearly everything in the room was flammable. Hundreds of pounds of cotton scraps, tissue paper, patterns, and wooden tables. So at the time of the fire, the only safety measures available to the workers, they kept buckets of water on the floor. They had 27 buckets of water on the floor, and they had a fire escape, which we'll talk about in a bit. It ends up collapsing. Most of the doors were locked, and those who were not locked only opened inwardly and were effectively held shut by the onrush of workers trying to escape.
Yeah. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
No. Several of the workers threw pails of water on the fire, but it quickly got out of control. Now, this is on the 8th floor, right?
Right.
So there's workers on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floor. It breaks out on the 8th floor. Most of the women on the 8th floor were able to get out. And the people on the 10th floor, where they had their offices mm-hmm. and where the owners, Max and Isaac, were located, they were able to get to the roof and get onto a neighboring building and escape. It's the women on the 9th floor that really got trapped. So the people on the 8th floor got out. The people on the 10th floor got warned, and they got out. But for some reason, no one told the women on the 9th floor about this fire. And the fire started the floor below them.
Mm-hmm.
So as I said, people on the 8th floor got out. People on the 10th floor, the executive offices, they got out. It's the women on the 9th floor that got caught. As the clothing materials fed the fire panic, panic ensued, and workers tried to escape any way they could. Everyone rushed to escape the fire. Some ran to they had four elevators, and this is back in the day where they had the elevator operators.
Right.
And they had two elevator operators working that day because it was a Saturday. And these guys were really courageous. They kept going up and down and taking people out. They got over 100 people out before, they just couldn't do it anymore. The fire was just too bad. They could only carry 15 at a time, but they were carrying like 30. They were only supposed to carry like 15. So there wasn't time for too many trips up and down. These are old elevators. Other women, and these are mostly women, there were some men killed, but other women ran to the fire escape, and 20 women were able to escape on the fire escape, but 25 women died when the fire escape collapsed.
Oh.
Yeah, so that had to be pretty horrific. Like I said, many on the 10th floor were able to escape, including the owners, Max and Isaac. They made it safely to the roof of a nearby building. So they made it out okay. It's the women on the 9th floor that really had the problem. There was this elderly elevator operator, and he risked his life, as I said. He went and made 4 or 5 trips and helped over 100 people escape. The flames eventually became too much, and the elevator stopped working. And at that point, some of the women tried to hoist themselves down the cable, the elevator cable, but they couldn't hold on, and they would just fall. Yeah. Eventually, women were just so desperate, they just started jumping down the elevator shaft. Mm. So it was a pretty gruesome. All of those died. All the ones that jumped down the elevator died.
Damn. Now, Timmy, by this time, all the avenues of escape were blocked. The elevators weren't available. The fire escape fall down. The doors of the hallway were locked. I mean, you were just trapped in there. Now, many of the workers headed to the window to find a means of escape, and it was a warm spring Saturday, so the streets were full of onlookers. As the women started clinging to the window ledges 9 stories above.
Yeah, it must have been a terrible sight.
At 4:45, the fire department was alerted to the fire. They rushed to the scene, raised their ladder, but it only reached the 6th floor.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, well, even today, a friend of mine's a fireman, and he told me if you're in a building and you're above the 11th floor, there ain't much they can do for you.
Yeah, no ladders.
I mean, if you're one person, they could possibly send a helicopter or whatever. But for large groups like that,
yeah, nothing.
The 11th floor is
up
that nope. That's as far as they're going to go. So They raised the ladders that reached. Now, to add to this already bleak situation, the water streams from the hoses could only reach the seventh floor.
Yeah, so they're getting no relief. Basically, it was, yeah. They couldn't do nothing for them.
So those on the window ledges started jumping, Timmy.
Ugh.
Now, although a few survived, most jumped to their death. Some, they tried to grab the ladders. Some would jump and try to grab the ladders two stories below, but for the most part, they were just bouncing off and plummeting to their death. Now, one 20-year-old actually survived it, only to die in the hospital of a wounds a couple days later. Now, upon finding that they could not find to use the doors to escape and the fire burning at their clothes and hair, the girls of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, and this group was mostly between 13 and 23, jumped nine stories to the death. It was like you've seen on 9/11. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Because once you get past the fourth floor, I believe it's fourth or fifth floor is when you reach maximum speed.
Oh.
So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
If you jump from, I'm pretty sure this is a
warm spring Saturday. So mm-hmm. you imagine the crowds that were just standing around watching these women just, you know, jumping to their death.
Well, one guy, the first one to jump was a man. Another man was seen kissing a young woman at the window before they both jumped to their death. Bystanders looked on in horror as one girl after another jumped to their death. Why don't you motherfuckers catch somebody? Shit. Get down there, break the fall or some shit.
Yeah, probably kill yourself, too.
Yeah, but they could get those blankets.
They did. They did get the blankets. What happened with the blankets was that these girls jumped in unison.
Right.
So they were all hitting these blankets, and they couldn't hold them. They were ripping these blankets into shreds, you know, like the firemen were holding.
So after each girl jumped, Timmy, a horrific thud could be heard as the body hit the concrete sidewalk. And then sometimes girls jumped three or four at a time, and the onlookers watched in horror as body after body fell to the earth. Now, the bodies of these teenage girls is just lying in the streets. Now, the blankets that the would-be rescuers used ripped at the weight because of the speed and the multiple bodies. Some of the girls tried to jump to the ladders, but they couldn't reach the ninth floor. None of them ever did reach the ladders. The fire escape in the rear of the building collapsed and trapped even more employees. Now, the fire was put out in a half an hour, but that was not soon enough. 19 bodies were charred against the locked doors. 25 bodies were found huddled in the cloakroom. They would have died of smoke inhalation. Of the victims whose ages were known, the oldest victim was Providenza Pano at 43. Youngest were 14-year-old Kate Leone and Sarah Maltese. Most died of burns, asphyxiation, blunt impact injuries, or a combination of the three, Timmy. Now here. Mm-hmm. In the aftermath of this, of the 500 employees, 146 were dead. The bodies were taken to a covered pier on 26th Street near the East River, and they were laid out in a long row with the heads of victims propped up so they could be identified by relatives.
Yeah, and there's photos of them. If you just Google,
Triangle Waste Factory.
Yeah, this fire. You'll see photos. They just line these girls up and down the street, and they prop their heads up so that they could be identified by relatives.
Now, the nearby Bellevue morgue was overrun with bodies, and a makeshift morgue was set up on the adjoining pier on the East River. Thousands of people lined up to identify the bodies of loved ones, and after a week, all but seven were identified. Fire caused the death of 146 garment workers, 123 women, 23 men who died from the fire. Most of the victims were recent Italian and Jewish immigrants aged 14 to 23. Now, a funeral procession, Timmy, was held on March 28, 1911, for the victims of the fire. 100,000 New Yorkers lined the procession route.
Yeah, people were angry at this. Because remember, they just had this strike.
The big strike.
And it's a well-publicized strike. And they were striking for better working conditions.
They wanted someone to blame, Timmy. And they charged Isaac and Max, the two owners, with one count of manslaughter. The manslaughter charge was a result of the owners ordering that one of the doors be kept locked to prevent theft. One of the bodies was found slumped against the locked door, leading investigators to believe that this woman would have survived if not for the locked door, which was in violation of a city ordinance.
Yeah. So there was so they, there was a code. They just were violating the code.
Yeah. Of course, investigators knew too well it was likely all lives would have been saved had the doors been unlocked. The investigation found that the locks were intended to be locked during working hours based on the findings from the fire, but the defense stressed that the prosecution failed to prove that, prove that the owners knew that. The jury acquitted the men of first and second degree manslaughter, but they were found liable of wrongful death during a subsequent civil suit, and plaintiffs were awarded compensation in the amount of $75 per deceased victim.
Man.
But, of course, the insurance company paid Harris $60,000, more $60,000 more than the reported losses, or about $400 per casualty.
Jesus.
2 years later, Max Blank was once again arrested for locking the door in his factory. Somebody should put a should have caught this sumbitch on fire and thrown him out the window.
Exactly.
He was fined $20. The fire and large number of deaths exposed to hazardous conditions and fire dangers that was, you know, unique to these high-rise factories. Shortly after the Triangle Fire, the New York City passed a large number of fire safety and building codes and created very stiff penalties.
You said stiff.
I occasionally will give somebody a stiff penalty, Timmy.
Okay.
I will occasionally give somebody a stiff penalty for noncompliance, Timmy, and that's what they did. many people don't look at it as a penalty. They look at it as a reward for compliance. But
one man's trash.
Yeah, exactly. Other cities soon followed New York's example. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire would change the regulation of government of business. But really, did it? Really?
Yeah, really.
When you think about it. Before the fire, the government had stayed mostly away from business, feeling it had no power to legislate it. After the fire, government could not avoid instituting laws to protect the workers. Once the New York legislature enacted safety laws, other states in the U.S. followed. Workers also began to look toward unions to voice their concerns over safety and pay. Samuel Gompers of the AFL had won a lot of trust and admiration by sitting in on the Factory Commission of 1911.
Yeah, so this is really a highly publicized, it created a debate about what role government, what role government should play in regulating businesses. They had pretty much ignored. Although in that case,
there were some regulations. Yeah,
that they cost him
$75 a person. So, an investigation found that one of the main reasons the death toll was so high was that there was inadequate escape routes for the workers. Some of the doors would have provided an avenue of escape, but they were kept locked to prevent workers from stealing from the company. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, some of the doors were locked. When the girls tried to escape through the locked doors, the fire consumed them. But even the doors that were not locked were of no use to the workers. The doors in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory opened only inward.
Yeah, we talked about that in the theater fire, remember?
The momentum or the force just crushed everything.
Right.
So when the girls tried to escape through the doors, the girls in the front could not open the doors because all the girls pushing from behind. If they'd opened outward, the onrush of girls would have opened the door. Now, later regulations required factories to make all doors open outward in factories. New regulations will also require all doors to remain unlocked during business hours in accordance with new regulations. New laws now require a sprinkler system, which must be installed if a company employs more than 25 people above ground level. The girls at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company had only 27 buckets of water to save themselves.
Yeah, and really, who's going to sit there and fight the... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're going to want to get out of
there. How
are
you going to do with 27 buckets of water anyway?
Yeah.
Now, today, there's a ton of laws to govern the condition of workplaces. Among those regulations implemented to let people out during a fire, multiple fire exits, unblocked fire doors, and clear pathways. Firefighting equipment also must be maintained in the building. Fire sprinklers for higher floors and portable fire extinguishers. Education for employees is a must. All employees are to be trained on the proper use of a fire extinguisher as well as escape routes and fire drills. Emergency evacuation plans are also required in writing and posted. Written fire prevention plans must also be available to me. Now, all areas that are fire hazard or that contain equipment or chemicals that could start fires must be maintained and controlled at all times. The United States Department of Labor classified this set of standards as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration standards. OSHA to me.
Yeah, they played a, this fire played a key role in
the development of OSHA.
Fire regulations that we take for granted today.
Today, the Ash Building where the fire occurred has been designated a historical national landmark and a New York City landmark.
146 people died.
It, you know, Timmy, but really, I mean, you think about it, how much has changed? I mean, we've written more regulations, but at the end of the day, when there's a big tragedy, Beverly Hills Fire, I mean, it always comes down, these tragedies almost always come down to somebody trying to make more money, cut corners, and nobody ever goes to jail for it.
No, no. And that is so true. I mean, that's and even today, I mean, if something like that occurred, there would probably be no ramifications in terms of the owners of the building or whatever. I mean, they may be fined, but you know, that becomes a part of cost of doing business.
Yeah. Well, know? I mean, and the most well known to me case is the Pinto.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Pintos, they decided, well, it was better, it was more cost-effective to pay up the victims who were blowing up than to recall the cars.
Yeah, and that was similar to the McDonald's case with the coffee.
Yeah. Yeah, people don't understand that case, and
I know,
they don't understand
that.
It's
used as it's always used by
for tort reform.
For tort reform, yeah. To saying how ridiculous that that suit was with the woman who got burned by the coffee, but McDonald's had been on put
They've
on
been
notice.
Put on notice numbers of times,
yeah,
time and time and time
their
again.
Coffees were being were at a higher.
They were dangerous.
They were dangerously high in terms of the temperatures that they were kept, and they, as you said, they were put on notice. Numerous times, it just wasn't. It was a cost benefit analysis to them to go in and change all their equipment,
right?
Or just continue to do what they've been doing. But
and pay
people
off
like
somebody
to point
that got burned.
At us, you know, as
how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, as a
what it really is about is the one time that a company got their ass handed to them for doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you haven't looked into that case, I would. encourage you to do so because it's often given as an example of frivolous lawsuit, and it was anything but that. I mean, that was a very deliberate decision by McDonald's that they made, and it was, like you said, it was based upon a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah.
It would cost too much to go in and change all the equipment they have to make the coffee at a reasonable temperature. That wasn't dangerous. But, all right. So your final thoughts, Colonel, on
It's
fire.
Just something we see, you know, not so horrifically, but time and time and time again. I mean, you have these miners. You have all kinds of things that just happen. And nobody
and you
is.
You've got a lot of people in a crowded space. There's always a opportunity for something tragic to happen like that. And as you said, even today, if you're in a high rise or something, you're pretty much on your own.
Yeah.
If something like that
I mean, those
happens.
People on 9/11, they were
They
were helpless.
Yeah.
There was nothing anybody could do for them, so.
All right. We would like to thank all of you who support the show on Patreon. If you would like to support us on Patreon, just go to patreon.com/historydweebs where you can give a little, you can give a lot,
or just a wee little bit to me.
All right. Colonel, give some shout-outs for our fine people who support us on Patreon.
James C. Wright. Tommy Lane, Jason Dykes, Terry Stafford, Shelley Garrett, Bridget Clavey, Brandy McBride, Jennifer Sabota, Maggie Glover, Mike Sadler, Jamie Dent, Maja, Tyrone, Amber Scoville, Marsha Boris, Stacey Alsop, Jody and Sean Wells, Amber Anderson, They Walk Among Us, Ben and Rosanna.
Our good our friends, lovely Ben friend. And Rosanna from They Walk Among Us, the number one podcast in Great Britain.
In Great Britain. Lorna Violet, and Ben and Roseanne mentioned that they might be coming, they might possibly be coming to the States.
I hope they do. They're talking about coming to CrimeCon in May.
And coming to Cincinnati and seeing a ball game with us, Timmy.
We would love that. We would love that. And we would encourage all our listeners to attend CrimeCon. Come and hang out with us. It's a week, I believe it's May 4th. Mm-hmm. The weekend of May 4th in Nashville. We're going to be there. You're going to be there, Colonel?
I'll be there,
court.
Timmy. I'll be there.
Yes. So we'd encourage everyone, and we hope to see our good friends Ben and Rosanna from They Walk Among Us.
Lorna Violet, Mike Dale, Kelly Charette, Karen Widener, Callie. Callie, you know Callie is just so damn funny, Timmy.
She is.
The girl could do stand-up for a little.
Yes, and very attractive young lady.
She is a beautiful young lady. Very smart, very, very pretty, but she is so damn funny. Lauren Meredith, Jessica Greeno, Mike Brown from Pleasing Terrors, Sarah Bloom, Amber Krupp, Joe from Now America History Podcast.
Another good podcast.
Catherine Cockeridge Richardson. Fiona, lovely Fiona Crisp, Laura O'Reilly, Christine Bourgeois, Aaron, Kimberly Cameron. Kimberly, now see, Kimberly Cameron, you start a fire like that today, she's going to be up
yes,
your ass, Timmy.
Yes, she is. Kimberly Cameron, attorney, she's a barrister.
Kimberly Cameron Esquire.
Timmy. Yes, yes.
Elise.
By the way, Elise posted a picture of her son. It's the cutest picture.
I know, she did.
Her little boy is the cutest baby.
History Goes Bump, Diane, Annette Petre, Lise, Jahara, Alicia, and Chip Mincy, one of our originals and one of our favorites.
Friends, and we're hoping to see them in Tennessee. They're from that way, down in Tennessee. Hope to see them in Nashville.
Marika Smith, Jeff, and Don Chestnut with their Jeff's Backroads to History and Poems by Jeff.
Yes, two great podcasts. I love their history podcast.
Karen Barnes, Rachel Flynn, Shirley Strapp, Todd Long, Lydia Fisher, Phyllis Munson, Melissa Montoya, Cindy Liu, Kristen Malachinsky, Heather Poole, Adam McWaters, The Vanished Podcast. And that's another one with a pretty baby to me right there.
Oh, Marissa.
Marissa, yeah. Yes. Canadian True Crime, Christy Lee, Insight, Our Ladies at Insight, Charlie and Allie, Joe Clifford, Mistress Veda, Ron Monasterio, Tracy Smith, Jess, John B., Nene, Bridget Bernard, Stacy, Kristen Hauer, Cheryl Weldon, Nicholas and Ryan, Julia Rodriguez, Michaela. Of course, we cannot go, we would really not, our mascot is Rudy.
Rudy the Wonder Dog.
The lovely Lady Beverly.
Yes. Happy holidays, Beverly. Thank you for the card. It's very sweet of you.
And as I said, Timmy, the matriarch of the podcast, Timmy, the reason we show up here to do this, Timmy, the lovely Dottie Scott.
Happy New Year's, Mom. And I'd like to give a shout out to Tara from Bloody Murder.
Oh,
our favorite
Tara,
podcast.
Yeah. Tara's funny.
And our friends at Collar Me Dead, another really funny podcast.
I have not been able to listen to that one
man,
yet.
Oh, man, it's hilarious. Check it out. Yes, it's very funny. They're like us, only they're two women.
Probably better looking and funnier.
They cuss like sailors.
Oh, do they?
It cuss like Brandy.
They cuss like Brandy?
Yes, yes. So
good.
Check them out. Collar Me Dead. Of course, check our friends Tara and Arnie out at Bloody Murder. Thank you all for joining us, and we'll see you next time on History Dweebs.
Good day.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.